Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the political wrangling over the so-called fiscal cliff and get some clarity on the real economic situation, not the fatuous theatrics the press is fixated on. Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, joins us to discuss how the people who caused our economic troubles are trying to exploit a phony crisis to enrich themselves further. Then we'll look into the Roger Ailes, the power behind the throne of right-wing politics in America, whose emissary was caught on tape offering the recently disgraced General Petraeus the presidency. Dr. Kerwin Swint, the author of Dark Genius, the influential career of legendary political operative and Fox News founder Roger Ailes, joins us to discuss the latest effort to corrupt our democracy by the mendacious Murdoch Empire. Then finally, we will speak with the former head of the Political Science Department at American University Cairo, Sheila Karapiko, about Egypt's embattled new leader and his power grab that has resulted in paralysis and polarization. We'll examine the likely outcome of next week's referendum on a new constitution that the opposition is boycotting, making it likely to pass since the fundamentalist bloc of Muslim Brotherhood voters are sure to show up in lockstep. And joining us now is Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. His latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
And the clock, of course, is ticking on this so-called fiscal cliff, which I think is an entirely phony, apocalyptic construction on the part of Republicans and the press who go along with it. But nevertheless, Congress is due to adjourn on December the 21st. So the last day to introduce a bill is December 18, and the president is leaving for Hawaii the day before on December 17. So what's your guess, Dean Baker, on whether anything's going to get done before then?
Well, I'd say it's probably a little better than 50-50 that something will get done. But I think the reason for that isn't that we have this disaster awaiting us December 31st or January 1st, as many have implied. It's that the Republicans understand at the end of the day they really have no bargaining power in this story, because the most immediate issue is what happens to the lower tax rates, the Bush tax cuts for the top 2%. And President Obama ran on this. You know, he said he would restore those tax rates to the Clinton era level. He won the election, and come this January 1st, if nothing's done, those tax rates go up. Now, after that, President Obama said he wants to keep the Bush tax cuts in place for the bottom 98%, which is something the Republicans want to do as well. That will eventually be a hit to the economy. Whether they do it by January 1st or not really matters almost not at all. So what's likely to happen if the Republicans don't agree to President Obama's terms before the end of the year is that they're going to come back in January and they'll agree to his terms and realize they looked extremely foolish for dragging it out. So we don't face a disaster. The Republicans face perhaps a political humiliation, having to turn around and tuck their tail between their legs. But the idea we face a disaster, it's just complete nonsense.
So the president and the Democrats deal, which is actually an exit for the Republicans, which is to just pass the tax cut, keeping the tax cuts for those under $250,000. And letting the tax cuts expire on those the top 2%. That's on the table. What are the chances of taking advantage of that exit strategy that the Democrats are offering?
Well, as I say, I think at the end of the day, they probably will do it because, I'm sure they'll do it come January if they don't do it before the end of the year, but I think it's more likely than not they will do it before the end of the year, just because dragging it out further will make it ever that much more embarrassing when they ultimately have to turn around and agree to the president's terms. Just to be clear, I would say it is a hit to the economy, but people have to understand what's going on here. This is deficit reduction. This is the stuff that people like me said is a bad idea in a weak economy, and now I guess everyone agrees with me, which I'm happy for, but they're misrepresenting exactly what happens, because it's not that
we're paying higher taxes January 1st, that matters. What matters is as the year were to go on, so we get more deducted off our paychecks January 15th, January 31st, when we get paid in February, when we get paid in March. That will be a drag on the economy, as will the spending cuts. But none of that happens January 1st. So the idea that, oh, my God, if we don't do this by January 1st, this is close to loony. I mean, it's really is nuts. I mean, and all the economists will agree on that. I mean, you have some will say the financial markets are going to panic. And to all those people, I go, well, you know, when you become an expert in financial markets, show me your $1 billion. I mean, you know, this is just silliness. You know, people are trying to create this this pressure on President Obama to yield. And in this particular case, there is no real pressure. It's just, you know, the Washington elites who are trying to say, oh, you got to give the Republicans something. The reality is he doesn't have to give them a damn thing.
But is he likely to give them something? They're talking about altering or, in fact, I think the word reform has been the so-called entitlements, which I think in many ways is another piece of semantic framing that's detrimental, just like the fiscal cliff is hyperbole. The entitlements, they're talking about reforming, and that makes people that believe in Social Security and Medicare, which, have, you know, in the case of the former, Social Security are actually paid for. From what you're telling us, Dean Baker, I don't see why the president should be talking about making cuts in either Medicare or Social Security if indeed the situation is as you describe.
Well, you know, the question is whether he wants to have cuts in Social Security and Medicare, because he certainly doesn't have to have them. And, you know, from a policy standpoint, you know, just kind of logic here is you go, is that what caused the downturn? No one could say that with a straight face. Do we, you know, we look at our elderly, do we think they're doing too well? I mean, the median income for someone over age 65 is a hair less than $20,000 a year. We hear talk, you know, Pete Peterson, the Wall Street investment banker, has been making a crusade of going after Social Security and Medicare for three decades now. He always goes around the country saying, well, I don't need my Social Security and Medicare, which, you know, of course is true. But the reality is there are very few Pete Petersons. The number of people we could identify among the wealth, among the elderly as being wealthy are very few and far between. You know, we talk about tax increases on high-income people. Our cutoff that at least President Obama has been using is $250,000. If you use the same cutoff for the elderly in terms of kind of Social Security and Medicare, you could zero it out for all of them, and it wouldn't make any difference. There just aren't enough Pete Petersons. There aren't enough wealthy people. So from a policy standpoint, doesn't make sense to be cutting these programs. You're really hard-pressed to answer yes.
Well, Dean Baker, again, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. You mentioned Pete Peterson, who's been on this jihad. It's telling us the sky is falling because of the deficits. He also funded in part the Simpson-Bowles Commission that ex-President Bill Clinton talks about as though it were the tablets that Moses brought down from the mountain. Obama has also talked positively about Simpson-Bowles. I noticed that Pete Peterson and the Center for American Progress have joined forces on a big conference they're holding on the deficit. The Center for American Progress is supposed to be close to the White House. Why are they drinking the Kool-Aid, too?
Well, it's, you know, it's hard to say their specific motives. I mean, I will point out some of the people close to the Center for American Progress have important Wall Street ties. Most importantly, Robert Rubin, you know, was President Clinton's Treasury Secretary and then went on to work at Citigroup. And, of course, was right in the middle of things when everything blew up on Wall Street. He walked away with over $100 million from his tenure there, and, you know, we got stuck with the bill bailing out Citigroup. But, you know, that's, you know, you do have people associated with the Center for American Progress with those ties. Now, that's not everyone there. Many of them are more liberal, more progressive. But you do also have people, as I say, that very much share, I think, Pete Peterson's agenda in certain areas.
Well, I'm just making the point that he seems to be making inroads into the so-called progressive think tanks, and that's nervous-making to the extent that there'll be some sort of voluntary fiscal suicide going on here that's entirely unnecessary. I mean, you were saying earlier that most economists, Dean Baker, have realized that austerity is a bad idea, and the evidence ought to be manifest from what's happening in Europe. But that's the consequences for these deficit reductions. And if the tax cuts for the middle class and working Americans are allowed to expire, then that's a huge hit to the economy. So again, there's no reason to feel confident that in the long run, the economic establishment hasn't drunk the deficit Kool-Aid.
There's a long-run and short-run issue. The short-run issue, should tax cuts for middle-income people expire, I think there's widespread agreement that they should not. So in terms of, you know, are we going to see a big hit to the economy in 2013 from that, I think the answer is clearly no. They will work that out. But over, say, the next 2, 3, 4 years, might they push more austerity than we should be having? I think that's a very real risk, because we really do have it in people's heads that the big problem facing the country is the deficit, as opposed to the fact that we're still trying to recover from the collapse of the housing bubble. That sort of disappeared from discussion. It's sort of surreal the way we just disappeared the collapse of the housing bubble from economic discussions.
Well, the other thing that's not likely to change, at least to my mind, is that the Republican Party, which have got us into this situation that has led to this sequester and all of this so-called fiscal cliff nonsense, is the fact that they've been playing chicken with the American economy. And the Republicans would apparently prefer to play chicken and extort and have these Tea Party tantrums, and they are prepared to govern. So do you see any indication that the Republicans are going to start governing?
Well, I think a lot's going to depend on the immediate outcome of this battle, because we have an immediate issue with how we resolve this fiscal standoff around January 1st. And a lot, I think, will depend on how that ends up being resolved, because the bigger issue, or I should say the more potentially disastrous issue, would be the extension of the debt ceiling, which is going to come due somewhere around February 20th. And there you really do face a serious situation. I mean, I think people exaggerate that, but if the Treasury Secretary has to say, I can't pay the bills, that would be a serious situation. And, of course, the Republicans did threaten to put us in that situation back in the summer of 2011. If they end up being, in effect, embarrassed by, you know, pushing us to this sort of standoff again, then they might let the debt ceiling go through a sort of routine thing, as it's always been in the past. So, you know, the question is whether they think there's a political payoff to this sort of brinkmanship, this sort of game of chicken. I think they actually were not happy how they came out of the last battle on the debt ceiling. And if they lose again with this fiscal standoff, then they may try different tactics.
Well, there are mixed signals on that, Dean Baker. In the Senate, Harry Reid brought up a bill that allowed the president to unilaterally raise the debt ceiling, and he required 51 votes for it to pass, and Mitch McConnell said no, he wants 60 votes. So there you have the filibuster again, which they don't even have to enact. They just have to say it, that they're going to filibuster it, and it all goes away, which is pretty surreal. And on the House side, there's a different some indication in as much as Boehner removed some of these Tea Party zealots from key committees. So I guess it's no surprise in the Senate that McConnell is not playing ball. But does it indicate further that they want to keep this option open to force a showdown over the debt ceiling in mid-February?
Well, for now, at least, I think they definitely want to keep the option open. Again, I think a lot will depend how the current battle is resolved. And if it ends up with, you know, the Republicans looking foolish, which I think there's a fairly good chance it will, since they've hugely overplayed their hand, then I think they might be inclined. They may not formally surrender the power, but they may simply agree to let the debt ceiling go through without a big fight. Because, you know, again, my guess will be that come February, they aren't going to want to be in a situation where, again, looks like they're holding the economy hostage.
Well, there's further evidence of the hollow nature of the Republican argument about the 2% protecting, you know, the tax breaks for the millionaires and billionaires. There was a meeting in Washington of all the top defense executives, and surprisingly, most of them, without being prompted, talked about how they're perfectly happy to have their taxes raised. And also, if you look at Wall Street, there's no indication of any panic over this so-called fiscal cliff. In fact, you could make the case that President Obama is one of the best moderate Republican presidents that Wall Street's ever had. I mean, the rich have never had it so good in this country. Surely they've never paid lower taxes. They're sitting on vast profits. Corporate America's sitting on tons of money. What the hell are they complaining about?
Well, I think the idea is that however much they have, they always think they could have more. And, you know, so however much they're paying in taxes, their view is they should pay less. However much they have in profits, they should have more. I think that's their thinking. And, you know, the Republicans are saying, yeah, we know Obama gave you lots of money, but we'll give you even more money. And I think that's kind of where it's coming from. But the idea that somehow if they're back at Clinton-era tax rates, I mean, they're still way below the tax rates that we had in the 50s and 60s, which were a period of enormous prosperity. So the idea that, you know, if we got back to the tax rates we had just 10 or 12 years ago, that's going to bring the economy to a standstill and no one's going to invest. I mean, it's kind of laughable. But, you know, what the hell? They're going to say that if they think it'll get them lower taxes.
Well, but isn't there something going on in terms of our oligarchy and the way they think? Because they're not all in lockstep here. My understanding is that this Grover Norquist fellow that's often referred to as Liberace with a wife, yet this strange character who has these peculiar little meetings that he has with all of his acolytes, and they intimidate the Congress into signing pledges not to raise taxes. He's entirely funded by a group of very right-wing billionaires like the Koch brothers. And I don't know why the press don't focus on who funds this guy rather than ascribe these mythical powers to this weird fellow. That's what's going on the one hand. And then, as I mentioned, you've got all these defense executives saying, no, we should pay more taxes.
Well, look, the media's done a horrible job on reporting on a whole set of issues. And, you know, and again, getting back to the whole issue about the debt crisis, we have this group, the Campaign to Fix the Debt, that Pete Peterson got started and is funded by other corporate executives. And they're treated with immense respect here. It's just as though they're independent experts coming in to intervene for the economy's good, as opposed to people who have an enormous amount at stake. I mean, it's kind of laughable, and it's considered incredibly rude when I point out to people that, you know, these are actually just a bunch of rich corporate executives who are trying to buy their way when they could not possibly get their agenda through the election. I mean, we did just have an election campaign. So, you know, if you thought it was a really good idea to cut Social Security, Medicare, because you're worried about the long-term debt, why didn't you go out and back candidates who were saying that? Well, of course, candidates who said that, you know, got their butts kicked last month. So you know, that should be pointed out in the media. But, you know, the reality is that a lot of people in the media have that same agenda, so they're happy to cover up for them.
Well, just in closing, Dean Baker, in terms of the nation's economic literacy, is there any indications that people are beginning to understand the economic nonsense being proffered by the deficit hawks vis-a-vis the reality that what really has put the economy in the toilet is what happened on Wall Street? And Wall Street is back stronger than ever, and the financialization of our economy continues. Is anybody starting to recognize that the problems on Wall Street are not in terms of Americans, middle class and working Americans living too high on the hog?
Well, I think people are enormously confused about the nature of the economy's problems, how we got here. There's been an enormous amount of confusion, much of it deliberately generated. The one real plus sign, I'll say, though, is that people think they have a right to their Social Security and Medicare, and they're very angry if people want to take it away from them. And that's really across the political spectrum. You see very little difference in the support for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, Republican, Democrats, people think of themselves as conservatives, even people identify with the Tea Party. The support is overwhelming, and it's across the board. And that's going to make it difficult for these guys to get their way. And, you know, they know the political realities, and that's why they have to try and do it all through these backroom deals.
Yeah, but the people are right to feel that they need to protect Social Security and Medicare because they paid for them.
Of course they're right. I'm not saying they're wrong at all. They absolutely should be defending them. And look, we're a rich country. We aren't poorer today than we were 20 or 30 years ago. We're a lot richer. So the idea that people should should be living more poorly today than they did in, you know, 1990 or 1980. That's crazy. We have the wealth. The problem is that it's all gone to those at the top. And insofar as we're concerned, we don't have the money. Well, we should get it from the people who have it, you know. And basically, they've rigged the rules so all the money goes to them. And we have to work on unrigging those rules. But, you know, basic understanding, people's exactly right. They paid for these benefits. They have them coming to them. And they should be very angry if politicians want to take it away from them.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the dark genius, the head of Fox News, Roger Ailes.
Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody want to tell it like it is to each other? Like you would to a sister or a brother. Cosmo Ball.